Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. My second guest today is an award-winning Canadian journalist and travel writer who did what many people dream of doing when they retire. She packed up her bags along with her husband and they traveled around the world. Irene Butler joins me around 12:40 today to share some of her journey that's documented in her new book. It's called Trekking the Globe with Mostly Gentle Footprints. First, I'm very pleased to welcome someone who's making a tremendous difference by raising awareness of what's going on with our food supply, our environment, and sustainability. Dan Imhoff is a researcher, author, and speaker. I could sit here for 20 minutes and tell you some of his accomplishments, many, many accomplishments, and I still couldn't do him justice. So suffice to say, he's the president and co-founder of Watershed Media. He's spent the last 20 years concentrating on issues related to food and farming, environmental design, and conservation. He's written many articles and books on these topics, including Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill, and Paper or Plastic, Searching for Solutions to an Overpackaged World. His new book, he is the editor of this new book. It's called The CAFO Reader, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories. And I don't think I've seen a book quite like this, so I'm pleased to have Daniel Imhoff to the show, on our show today. Dan, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this book is very different, Dan, to anything I've seen. I've seen a lot of film that shows some of the same kind of images that you have in the book. But I want to begin with something that you say in the book about how our food says a lot about our culture and our society. And why did you want to put this book together today?
Well, I was actually asked to put the book together. Another organization had started production on it, and they couldn't get to the finish line for numerous reasons. And it is a companion to an earlier book called Fatal Harvest that really about 8 years ago looked into industrial crop production. And when they did that book, they intentionally decided not to include animal food production. As someone who's followed agricultural issues, looked into alternatives to conventional agriculture, with a real concern for the environment and local food production over many years, though, this topic of factory farms, of animal factories, or CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, as the EPA calls them, that just surfaces as an increasing problem in our food system as we turn over the production of animal food products to larger and larger corporations, and as we as consumers eat more and more animal food products in our diet, and it begins to threaten our health. Mm. And our environment.
Yeah, and after looking at this book, you've got, let me just look here, I think you've got 450 images from photographers across the globe. You've got more than 30 essays by today's leading thinkers on food. And for those who are watching on webcam today, you can see it's a huge book. It's the kind of book you'd have out on a table. It is huge, and some of the pictures are very graphic, but boy, it makes you certainly think differently. And after looking at this, Dan, I'm not going to put factory and farm together again. They don't belong in the same sentence.
Yeah. There's a number of things going on, and part of it is, you know, as we look toward our food increasingly as the way that all people can make conscious decisions about the world around them, you know, not all of us are engineers or politicians or industrial designers, but all of us eat three times a day. And the decisions that we make about the foods that we have a direct impact on the natural world, on the people who grow our food, and of course, on our own health. The thing about the CAFO industry, about the industrial animal food product industry, is they've invested a lot of money and resources into, first of all, projecting an image that the way animal food products are raised in this country is healthy and wholesome and almost still echoes the nostalgia of the past when animals were raised by many, many more small farmers in pastures and outdoors and in far different scenarios than they are today. And then B, also, they've really made it very difficult for us to see, to have transparency, to be able to see how animals are raised today. In some states, it's illegal to take a picture of a CAFO without permission of the owner. In many states, it's illegal to say anything disparaging about food production, because you know big industries that increasingly control our animal food products really don't want us to know. And so when you know we were looking for photos to illustrate this, to try to pull back the curtains on how what happens inside these animal factories, one of our main resources in finding photographs were news agencies. We purchased a lot of photographs from Associated Press and from Reuters and from other professional photography agencies that were given access and model releases. And so, you know, there's no way that the industry can say, oh, this is some, you know, left-wing animal rights vegan food conspiracy. In fact, we purchased many photos that were taken for newspapers and news agencies around the country, around the world.
Yeah, and I would echo that because I've been to many environmental film festivals that, you know, with very reputable journalists from and filmmakers from around the world who are showing the same kind of images, but they don't always have easy access. And I know a friend of mine who's a journalist in California could not even get a lot of these places that he was trying to get information from were manned by migrant workers, and he could not even get anybody to talk with him for fear of repercussions. But so I want to look at the transparency issue. But before we get there, I want to look at some of the myths around industrialized, and I'm not going to use the word farming again, about these industrialized factories. One of the reasons we're told, oh, it's necessary to raise animals this way is because it's cheap. Not true, correct?
Well, you know, it's only cheap if you don't add in all the true costs of production. And I think that it's very true, and it's increasingly true that industrial animal food production is really coming at the expense of a number of things. One is external costs to the environment, to polluted waterways, to impoverished communities. Because, you know, normally when a CAFO enters a region, it's normally not just one operation, but it's many operations. And the typical place for CAFOs to set up shop in America has been, you know, rural regions that have been economically depressed for many years, also sometimes with political systems, environmental regulation systems that are manipulable. And you get all of a sudden a concentration of poultry, for example, or hog production or dairy production in one area. And they're, you know, these as you say, these are not farms, these are factories. And these barns contain thousands of big mammals or hundreds of thousands of birds. And the concentration is so great that you end up with so much waste that there's just not enough land to usually safely absorb it. And then, I mean, that's not counting the stench factor, how difficult it becomes for residents in these communities to just live a healthy life in the country. And then associated health problems and you know, pollution of waterways. That's kind of on the production end. As taxpayers, we pay billions of dollars in USDA subsidies each year to subsidize grain production, which mainly goes to produce cheap feed for these for factories, as well as we even use USDA conservation money to build manure processing facilities for these operations. And for any other industrial enterprise, you know, that would be the cost of production, right? That would be a cost of investment. And in fact, tax billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies go toward the management of waste for these huge operations. And these are just a few of the costs. Now, you know, the health implications we're starting to see very visibly in the last few weeks with the egg recall from Iowa.
Yeah.
There we had
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to jump straight into the health side of things, because you also just busted another myth talking about the waste. And that was that they're efficient. They're obviously not. So let's take a quick break. My guest in this segment is Daniel Imhoff. He's the editor of this great book called CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories. I think this is a really important book. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce at joycechapman.com. Next week on Conversations Live, have you ever felt like a square peg in a round hole? What if you feel that way at work? How do you survive and even thrive when you struggle to be one of the in crowd? Career coach David Cooper joins Vicky to share solutions from his new book, Outsiders on the Inside, How to Create a Winning Career Even When You Don't Fit In. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And if you'd like help from David Cooper about being a square peg in a round hole, email Vicky at info@conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Click the shows page on 1150kknw.com for the scoop on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're talking today with publisher, editor, author, researcher about a subject that's not particularly easy to talk about, certainly not easy to look at. If you're looking on the webcam and can see these pictures here, I'm not going to be showing you some of the worst ones here. But it's an important subject, and I feel very strongly that if we don't face up to what's happening, I can't see where it's going to go. It's only going to get worse. Don't you agree, Dan?
Yeah, you know, it has to be. I read a lot of books about agriculture and the environment. And I can list probably 20 in the last few years that put this issue of industrial animal food production up there in the very top of problems that we need to address from so many different angles.
We talked a little about transparency in the beginning segment, and I want to go further into that. You have a whole section of this book dedicated to what the industry doesn't want us to know. You take a look inside CAFO, which, of course, is this book is called CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories. And I wanted to talk about what the industry doesn't want to know, but I particularly wanted to ask you before we get deeper into that about livestock cloning, because I did not realize to the extent that this is happening. It's happening a lot, correct?
Well, you know, just as they are trying to genetically engineer crops to be resistant to herbicides and, you know, many other chemicals, even have natural pesticides bred into them, genetically engineered into them, you also have a whole biological science industry trying to create the perfect factory animal. I mean, and it's really just an extension of the way that we're looking at these animals as just highly replaceable, fastly, you know, rapidly growing protein units on some kind of assembly and disassembly line of food production.
Mm-hmm.
What they're really trying to shoot for is, you know, animals that, because nature has such a difficult time dealing with the stresses and the conditions of this food production, they're trying to then engineer traits into animals. For example, you know, trying to take the mothering gene out of a hog or a chicken or a cow, and to reduce the stress that they feel when their animals are when their offspring are taken away. Or, you know, try to engineer a chicken without feathers so that it's easily plucked, or a hog whose waste contains far less phosphorus than the normal hog who's eating this intensive industrial diet of corn and soybeans. Any production problem that they have related to concentration and confinement, they're right now trying to engineer their way out of it. Through genetic engineering, and in fact, you know, cloning is just one of the techniques that they have. The FDA has not come out against cloning, and in fact, you know, we can find clone foods in our diet, not labeled, and you know. Many people have quite a problem with that.
Yeah, because if somebody has an ethical problem with cloning, they should have the right to know that piece of pork they're buying is come from a cloned pig, and they should have the right to make the choice. And our choice basically is being taken away from us at every turn.
Well, hopefully, you know, and this is just one of the many facets of this issue of CAFO food production. And, you know, the patenting of life, the ownership of life through corporations, and the technological extent at which we are going to produce such a massive output of animal food products that are, you know, literally overwhelming the planet, overwhelming our waterways, and really when eaten excessively, overwhelming our own health.
Right. If the industry is as productive and healthy as it would like us to think, why don't they make it available to us? I mean, that has to be the first big red flag there. What else is going on that they don't want us to know about?
Well, I think one of the more shocking things that I found as I went through the process of researching the book was really what we feed to animals, the whole feeding system, and certainly we are what we eat, and then we are also what we eat eats. The most shocking, you know, thing that I found, I think, is how much poultry manure is fed to cattle, to beef cattle in their rations.
Wow.
It's been known for quite some time that that if you feed poultry manure to a cow, it has protein content. They will gain weight. And, you know, you can feed them so much before they get sick. But this idea of, you know, having cows and treating and just feeding them a completely unnatural diet, but also just taking this waste product that you have from one industry and putting it into the feed system of another.
Mm-hmm.
The real concerns there are that it's still legal to feed slaughterhouse waste as a feed product in poultry production. Well, some people have said, well, what happens if that feed falls on the floor of the chicken house and then it's fed back to cattle? Then you could actually be feeding slaughterhouse waste to cattle.
Right.
And you know, the health reasons are just one horrific aspect of this issue. The ethical issues are another, and that really is, we're denying the real essence of these animals' beings in our over-industrial production of them. We're really treating them as just, you know, protein units to feed the masses.
That's it. That's a product.
You have to ask yourself, if we're not much better than this. And so, you know, whatever reason that you have, I think you should try to apply it to, you know, to these issues.
Mm. Let's talk about what you call nuclear meat, using radiation and chemicals to make food safe. I remember watching a film not so long ago that said E. coli would not exist if we just take some of these factory animals and put them out to pasture for a week or 10 days before they were slaughtered. And you talk in the book about how we use radiation and chemicals to make the food safe. Let's talk about that a little, Dan.
Well, again, you know, it's like instead of creating a healthy way to produce these animals, right, instead of dealing with the scale problem and the feed problem and the antibiotic problem, and the concentration of them, like, for example, it's not uncommon to have a feedlot that has 100,000 cows at any time. These are massive operations.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of really dealing with the scale, we're just saying, well, why don't we just use radiation to then clean up the product, you know, before it goes out for consumption. And that is, it's a logic that really boggles the mind.
It does.
And it's what you hear, let's say, in the recent egg recall is that, well, shame on you consumers for not cooking those eggs properly and exposing yourself to salmonella, rather than, you know, shame on us as a society to let the problem get this bad, to have it be so hard to regulate these operations, to have, you know, to have just two operations be producing, you know, 500 million eggs for recall.
Right, right. I want to talk about a little segment in the book called Don't Eat the Black Snow. It's called nutrient banking, and it's a new practice, and it's the latest euphemism, I understand, of disposing of millions of gallons of manure. They call it nutrient banking. Tell us about that a little.
Well, again, it's industry spin. You know, we're told that when CAFO operations go in, it's going to be this huge boon to rural communities because there's going to be, you know, a great resource of manure and fertilizers for the surrounding farms. The problem is that, you know, the animals don't just make waste when the farmers need it. They're fast-growing industrial breeds that are making waste all the time, huge volumes of it. And it doesn't, they don't, you know, poop out like this perfectly balanced organic fertilizer either.
Right.
It's really high in phosphorus and nitrogen and all a whole slew of other compounds that can be potentially toxic. And these operations have to get rid of these massive volumes of waste. And one thing that they've taken to is in many areas in of the whole world, really, is to spray manure on the snow with the idea that it's going to just stay on the fields and then, you know, naturally decompose in the springtime and be there and available for crops during planting. But the real question is, you know, well, what happens if the snow melts or what happens if it rains?
Exactly.
And throughout farm areas all over the country, we have drainage systems that go out into our waterways to drain water off of fields so that they can be planted and don't flood. And, of course, what happens to that nutrient-banked manure is oftentimes it becomes fugitive, and it goes into our waterways and, you know, through these drainages into wells and into the water system.
Mm. So many topics we could talk about around this industrial animal factory situation. But I want to ask you this. We're going to leave our listeners with some positive, some best practices at the end of this segment. But I want to ask you this, and how does this make sense? Because I saw a lot of fish farms when I was out in Norway, traveling down the coast and up some of the fjords just a couple of months ago. But I read in the book that 70% of U.S. seafood is exported. 80% of what we eat is imported.
Well, you know, we're talking about our wild fish. So much of the wild fish, the beautiful, you know, salmon runs that still exist, a lot of the fresh foods from our fisheries are really cherished and valued in other parts of the world. And increasingly, we sell our wild fish and we increasingly import particularly farmed salmon and shrimp from all over the world. The salmon is really coming from Canada and Chile increasingly.
Right.
And Norway. And, you know, what we found in Chile was a complete collapse of the industrial aquaculture from overuse of antibiotics over time. They used so many antibiotics to deal with the intensive confinement conditions that basically in 2009, they lost almost 90% of their salmon.
Wow.
Due to a virus that they could no longer fight.
So even though these fish farms are in the ocean with the regular wild fish, they're still fed what we'd call factory food. They're still fed antibiotics. They're pooping that out. What kind of impact is that going to have?
Well, what you have is basically in a lot of these industrial aquaculture farms, they're like floating hog farms. You know, with the salmon, the challenge with salmon and the insanity of the salmon really is that salmon are carnivorous fish. So you're basically harvesting fish to feed to these fish in pens. And, you know, they're fast-growing fish. Now we have a genetically engineered Atlantic salmon that grows, you know, I don't know, 4 to 6 times faster than a wild one. You try to confine them in these pens, and the numbers are so high, they're susceptible to lice and other viruses that they use you know, at least in the case of Chile, they were using huge amounts of antibiotics, many of which are illegal by the FDA, mm-hmm. to keep these aquaculture operations on life support. And you just have to ask yourself, if you need antibiotics to keep them alive, how healthy can the system be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can understand that you're going to have individuals that need treatment, but this is just regular. This is you know, part of their feed. This is just part of the, you know, the weekly ration.
Right. Well, I know my great grandparents and uncles and all those generations before were proud beef raisers in Hereford in England, and I think they'd be rolling in their graves hearing what's going on here. It's not an easy subject, but I do believe it's a really important subject. We need to know where our food is coming from. I always say vote with a dollar. It's the best vote we have. You say vote with your fork. What can we do? What can we do? How do we know for sure that our food is organic? I know I have to let you go in a minute, but how can we make sure our food is organic? What's the best thing we can do to make sure this industry goes away?
Well, you have to work on various fronts, but, you know, you as a consumer, we as a consumer do have the ability to learn as much as we can about the food products that we buy, especially the animal food products. Some kind of direct relationship with the producer is probably the highest form of certification, but I think that you can increasingly look for pasture-raised products. You can try to educate yourself a little bit about perhaps vegetarian cuisine. If you know, a lot of people are adopting one meatless day per week. School districts are doing it. Mm-hmm. Families are doing it, where you have a meatless day. I think probably most important to understanding where your food comes from and how it was produced and under what conditions, it is also just make the most of what you can with what you buy. You know, consider buying less but buying better quality, and really honor and in the way you cook and the way you consume that food and the relationship that you have with the producer.
Yeah.
And as you're voting with your fork, don't forget that whenever elections are held, you have public officers that are representing you in the government, and they really need to have a position on this issue. They have to have a position on grass, pastured food production and regional food production. One of the real challenges that we have is, as we've given over our food production to increasingly larger, faraway operations, we've, in many areas, lost our ability to grow food and process it and distribute it ourselves. And that's going to be the hard work of the next 20 years, is rebuilding those local food production systems where they're not so far away.
Yeah.
And we can, you know, keep the money and the good food at home.
Dan, I thank you so much for being with us today. You're doing great work, and you know, I do believe it's very important work. And where can listeners find out more about you, the work you do, and the book?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate your interest and the great job you did on this topic. I'm at www.watershedmedia.org. You can learn about the book at www.cafothebook.org.
Okay, and CAFO is C-A-F-O. thebook.org. And the book is called CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories. And once we've seen, we can't say we don't know. For
absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. So again, my guest, Daniel Imhoff, and please do stay with us. We'll be right back with Irene Butler, for we're going to have a change in pace.
Watch him as the world goes. expand your loving heart at the One Gathering 4, October 3rd, 4 to 6:30 p.m. at the Theater off Jackson in downtown Seattle. I'm Jennifer Yost, creator of the One Gathering. Join me and my special guests, Narian and Janet Balzo, Paul Chokotin Wagner, author speaker Carol Haywood, and Vijay Tassara at this multisensory program intended to lift our consciousness. Visit theonegathering.com for details and to buy tickets.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's AndreaKay.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Don't touch that dial. You might miss something life-changing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And our first topic today was a difficult topic. It really is difficult to look at some of the photographs. And, you know, I've also seen a lot of documentary films on this topic. But, you know, if we don't acknowledge what's going on, it's just going to get worse. And it really is. If you have an ounce of compassion for an animal, you know, I'm certainly not a bleeding heart liberal. I like steak. But there is a better way to do it. And Dan Imhoff's book is very powerful. So because we talked about a difficult subject in the beginning, we're going to have a change in pace now. We're going to talk about trekking around the globe with Irene Butler. She's an award-winning travel journalist. She's got degrees in psychology and gerontology. And after 35 years in the workforce, her life now revolves around new travel adventures with her photographer husband, Rick. Irene's new book is called Trekking the Globe with Mostly Gentle Footsteps, 12 countries in 12 months. Irene Butler, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Vicki, for inviting me to be a part of your show.
Sure, and you're joining us from Vancouver, BC today.
Yeah.
And let's start about this because you were baby boomers. You've been in the workforce a long time. You know, many people have this dream of, you know, hey, when I quit work, I'm going to go travel the world. But you guys actually did it. I read that your husband asked you one day if we could travel for a year on the same amount of money that it would take for us to be couch potatoes, would you do it? And what happened? How did you get this off the ground?
Well, Vicki, first of all, like, we are on the leading edge of the baby boomers, and I believe that there are 77 million in the States, and it's one-third of Canada's population who've recently retired or will be retiring the next decade. And our attitude towards unrealized goals was be, if not now, when? And we've always dreamt of traveling extensively. So that's how we came to start our planning for this trip. But when I thought everything was all set, we had all the legalities of selling our business, and we had planned ahead how to deal with income taxes and bill payments while away, letting everybody know what we were doing, putting our stuff in storage, we bought a one-world ticket. And Rick, he comes up in out of the blue with, as you were mentioning, what if we could travel the world for the same cost as staying at home? Well, first of all, I thought, Rick, you've got to be kidding. And And I said to him out loud, I realize we can't spend as freely on a three-week vacation, but if we're going to be too tight-fisted to enjoy ourselves, we may as well sit home and watch the Travel Channel. But he had already, he's a numbers person, and he'd already worked out a budget based on pricing from guidebooks and internet research. And he balanced the countries that were less expensive to travel through with those that were more expensive. And he came up with, he figured we could travel for $50 each a day, which is a a total of $100 a day.
Mm-hmm.
So I was willing to go along with this, but I intuitively felt it would be wise to have some agreed upon modus operandi, which led to the development of a bunch of travel mottos.
Do you know, I love those travel mottos. I thought, because the first one was, we're not here to suffer.
Yeah.
Because I know people who have traveled and they get into, especially if they're a married couple, they get into these little, spits and spats.
Yeah.
And you'd worked all this out ahead of time about what you were going to do. So tell us about those.
Well, we're not here to suffer. It was kind of a counterbalance to Rick's budget. So what I felt is that this motto, our comfort range should be adhered to in accommodations and eateries. And like different countries, of course, have different standards. And part of that motto was that we're never going to be chintzy when it comes to visiting the sites we've traveled so far to see. So that worked out, and we actually met our budget, and we did not suffer. We got into a few instances that were kind of hair-raising and bizarre, but all in all, we came away from this whole year without getting a divorce. So that was a good thing.
Well, the last of your five, you had five mottos. We're not here to suffer. Expect the unexpected. Don't go with preconceived notions. Travel at a leisurely pace. Follow the sun. You always wanted the spring sun to have warmed wherever you were traveling to.
Yes.
And that's probably one I would have adopted too. And find ways to maintain our own breathing space, because being together 24/7 would be a major adjustment. So I think that's good. But what you did travel for 12 months together. What did you, when you came back, was your relationship stronger and how did it change?
Well, we had changed a lot, more than in our relationship. Like, we had changed a lot. As in the vagaries of travel, like, what we had found out is that all your background doesn't matter. Nobody out there, as you go from city to city, country to country, knows anything about you, what your accomplishments were. So you keep redefining yourself according to what country that you're in. And we also realized that we have led quite a pampered existence in Canada, being raised here and as North America in total. When you're traveling, kind of not in five-star hotels, but when you're on the front lines, the foreignness starts to fade away and you begin to see things through the eyes of and the perspective of other people. And we saw poverty that was dire poverty and different things that made us realize how fortunate that we are, and that a lot of the unsung heroes are on the streets of India and Nepal and China and all these places. So we changed in that way, and we'll never be the same. We grew and were enlightened, but in our own relationship, we were much more easygoing as far as our human foibles. We kind of accepted them, and it actually, our relationship did strengthen.
Mm. And I read that you came back as with a minimalist credo. Who needs 50 shirts when I've only had, you know, four or five for the last 12 months. So
yeah.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you, I know one of your goals was to really immerse yourself in some of these cultures. You went to places like Australia, China, Tibet, Nepal, India. I want to ask you, some of your favorite cultures and some of your favorite experiences. We're talking today with award-winning Canadian journalist Irene Butler, and her book is called Trekking the Globe with Mostly Gentle Footsteps, 12 countries in 12 months. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Let's play 10 questions. What is new at KKNW?
Real estate radio.
What's the show about?
Real estate?
Actually, Val, we focus on buying, selling, owning, and financing residential real estate.
That's right, at the ground level, where most of us live.
Who are you guys?
Well, I'm Rob Gray, a broker for John L. Scott in West Seattle.
And I'm Craig Goble with Cascade Pacific Mortgage.
We're both active real estate professionals, and we're in the trenches every day.
Don't miss Real Estate Radio at its new time, 2 o'clock every Thursday here on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back. I'm talking in this segment with Irene Butler. She's written a book called Trekking the Globe with Mostly Gentle Footsteps. I keep wanting to say footprints. Footsteps. Newly retired baby boomers, both her and her husband, they immerse themselves in the cultures across four continents for the same cost as it would have cost them to stay at home and be couch potatoes. So I think that's very intriguing. I know that you wanted to just go with no preconceived notions and be as open as possible. Tell us some of the cultures that amazed you the most.
Well, Vicky, they totally are all amazing, and they're each so unique and each so different. And so it's we love them all. But the ones that were most foreign to us, I guess, were most intriguing and where there was the most of a language barrier. And one of the places that we found totally intriguing was China. We did take 6 months of Mandarin before we left, which helped somewhat, but at times...
That was dedication.
Yes.
that's not an easy language.
No, and it was so funny because when we were there, we remembered so many words, but we forgot the tone. So, like, if you say ma, there's four different tones, and it either means horse or mother or curse. And so you don't want to come out and say, how's your mother? So, because we totally forgot the tones.
But, yeah, the whole language is built on tones, isn't it?
Yes. And sometimes there would be a whole month that would go by when we were in the major cities, it was fine, but we went to some of the off the beaten path places, and there would be times when there wasn't an English speaker at all for 3 or so weeks at a time. So there was a lot of gesturing and all sorts of things that went on, but we managed to come through those countries with some wonderful, totally wonderful experiences. And it just goes to show how there's absolutely no barrier in the world that, friendliness and smile and a smiling face can't overcome.
Right.
Because there's people all over that open their hearts and their homes to us.
Mm. And as I said, you did go to some very diverse places. I mean, it's very different in Australia than it is in India, for example. I know I've had several American friends who went to India and went through terrible culture shock. How did you find India?
Well, we loved it. The first time we landed there, we were in Calcutta and we stepped out on the street, and it is so chaotic, mm-hmm. and all your senses, you're overstimulated, and we just fell in love with it. In fact, we seldom go back to a country twice because there's another 20 or more on our list. But India we have because it's such a large country, and we just fell in love with the culture, and we always felt safe there. Like there might be somebody that might, you know, have you pay too much or whatever, but they do it with such a wonderful head-bobbing nod that, you know, it's just, we just never felt threatened or unsafe there.
Mm. It's interesting that we think we have sensory overload here, but when you go to a city in somewhere like India, it's like times 100.
It is. The populations, that was another thing, the mass humanity. Like our population is really small in Canada, and yours is quite a lot larger. But when you get to over a billion people, it just seems that everywhere that you go, there's just, like a symphony of either bicycles going in one direction or vehicles going all over the place. And it's just mind-boggling to us. But we just love that culture, and we love that chaos.
Mm. You say that despite where you went, you came back with the deep belief that everyone wants to live in peace and harmony, and that everyone, no matter which country, whether they're in the city or the country, everyone has three basic goals: to take care of their family, provide food, shelter, education, and medical care.
Yes. We saw firsthand how there's so many political differences and different levels of corruption, even in different countries. And there's radicals, and there's lack of social programs, and all kinds of natural disasters, and everything that people are up against. But basically, all people want those things in life. And it's the people on the street that supersedes everything else that is political, and all these things that are the total umbrella. And that's usually the only thing that we see or hear about is, you know, the negatives. And so, you know, the more we learned and the more we were involved and immersed in the culture, the more we realized how little we knew about these cultures and the people themselves.
Mm. And yet, at the end of the day, we're not all that different, are we?
We're not at all.
I had one listener who had emailed me and wanted to know where he could find information about travel dangers. And I know there's I'm going to give it to you right now, Steve. It's travel.state.gov. And then if you go onto that website, they give you a lot of international travel warnings and requirements for your visas. But I know that also if you go with a great attitude, that helps a lot. And it sounds as though you, Irene, and your husband went with a fantastic attitude and came back with an even better one.
Yes, we most certainly did. It was the most daring for us. It was really daring to uproot for a year. But it was the most enlightening and rewarding year of our lives. And we haven't stopped. It's a major transition, your retirement. And from my basis in psychology, I've often been told that it's one of the best transitions is to travel extensively, because you get away from routine.
Right.
And you kind of have more time to focus on really what you want to do
your life. I think also you don't have that feeling of loss, because you know, if you stay at home, I've lost my job kind of thing. I've lost my identity. But when you go out into the world, you are experiencing brand new things and can become a brand new you. We are at the end of our show now, and I want to thank you for being with us today, Irene. I enjoyed reading about your adventures, and I know you've got many more plans, so I'm sure we'll hear from you again.
And Vicki will be at Third Place Books in Seattle on Wednesday, September the 15th at 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And also on October the 12th at 7:30, we're in Worldwide Books and Maps in Seattle. So we'll be coming out and reading from our book and having a slideshow of pictures, and just have a question and answer period on how exactly we did budget and the different things that are embedded, the travel tips in our book.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for being with us today. My guest again, Irene Butler, her book, Trekking the Globe with Mostly Gentle Footsteps, 12 Countries in 12 Months. I want to thank you for being with us today. If you have feedback on today's show, you can find me on our website, conversationslive.net. Thanks for being with us. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.